It's Common Science with Jeff Danner. He has the Common Science blog on our website, chapelboro.com. It updates every Sunday. He joins us every Monday to talk about the column. This week's column is about hail, and we'll get to that in just a couple minutes. But first, we've got some breaking science news today, or at least a breaking science what is going on question, because our top story for today, we talked about this with, by the way, Jeff, thanks for joining us. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine, Aaron.
Every so often, I find myself ranting, and then I realize I don't want the other person to speak. But how are you?
I am doing just fine. But rant away, sir.
Okay, good. So our top, that is the best thing that I could possibly hear. So
I'm here for you, Aaron.
All right, good. Top story for the day, of course, QVC truck, which has driven up and down MLK Boulevard numerous times by all accounts over the last few days, and they're getting ready for this cool live QVC cooking show featuring a Chapel Hill-based chef. It's going to be downtown. They're going to be doing a lot. It's going to be super cool. They've got these trucks around to prepare for that. Truck's been going up and down MLK for the last few days. Today, it's going down MLK or up MLK, and it collides with a power line and takes down a transformer. And fortunately, no injuries, but knocks out power to a big chunk of Chapel Hill for a good while earlier today. Power's back on for everyone. Traffic's back flowing again. No injuries, but kind of a significant thing today. And the driver of the truck said, well, our truck is 13 foot 6 tall. Power lines are supposed to be no less than 14 feet tall. Somehow today, the top of the truck collides with a power line and takes it down. But the truck's been driving up and down the street with no issues for the last few days. So, Jeff Danner, what could possibly have caused a power line to suddenly sag at least 6 inches, if not more, in the space of less than 24 hours?
Well, so not having followed the story quite all day long, just I got some of this information from Aaron in the break.
Yeah.
And, you know, I did some... I wish you could see it here. I've got a... It's almost the back of an envelope. And
yeah,
a calculator.
Jeff was doing math during the break, on so this is cool.
And my calculator on my phone. And so I don't have all the measurements, but based on some estimates, I think the driver, if the wire itself were to sag, which let me just say up front, I think that's very, very, very unlikely. I mean, all things, be they metal or plastic, are going to expand a little bit when they get warmer, and so it could sag a little bit. But
we were talking earlier today about the humidity possibly causing it, but
I'm throwing the humidity theory away immediately.
All right.
Now, temperature would cause the wire between the poles to get a little bit longer. But in my little calculation here, which just some caveats, could have made an error because I did it quickly, but I think I'm close. I think for the wire to sag 6 inches between two typical poles, it would have had to expand it enough to be 1.5 feet longer.
Okay.
That's a tremendous amount of expansion.
Yes.
So the wire's not sagging because the wire itself is elongating due to temperature or humidity or anything. Right. So that leaves us with a couple of things. And I think probably if somebody hit a pole and the pole was tilted, that either would have been obvious before or it would be obvious now, although you might not be able to see it depending on how hard the wire pulled. But I'm thinking, as you look up there on typical assemblies, the wire is held by different brackets and other pieces of the equipment. There could have been some wind damage that, I don't know, caused one of the brackets on one side to...
But we didn't have any wind this weekend, though, did we?
Well, but now let's say that, again, I don't know how many 13.5-foot trucks. We had some good storms in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah.
You know, it's possible there was some damage to something holding the wire. I think that would probably be something they would look at. You know, the truck itself, we don't know what the clearance was.
Right.
So a good question
would
be...
Yeah, this is a report that's coming from the driver
of the
truck that hit the power line in the first place. May have an incentive to,
But then, you know, the other question I would have is, Was he making the delivery such that the truck was full, or had he finished the delivery and the truck was empty?
Okay.
Right, an empty truck is going to ride, again, I don't know the numbers, but the empty truck directionally is going to ride
higher on its
suspension. So, you know, maybe on a normal day, he didn't have the 6 inches of
clearance,
but only a few. And some combination of factors, but I'm putting the kibosh on the humidity and the temperature theory.
So, between wind damage and a possible car striking the pole earlier or the truck riding higher because
higher
it was empty, what's your wild guess as to what's most likely?
I'm going to go with bracket damage on the pole. So
okay.
We'll see what comes out of the report, out of the investigation, and we'll pick up on it again. Actually, in 2 weeks, I'm gonna miss you next week.
Yeah, we'll miss you next week, but we'll come back in a couple of weeks. So you heard it here first. The most likely but not definitive scientific explanation is that something damaged the pole earlier this weekend, and that might have caused something to happen.
Yeah, I know it would have been a much cooler answer if we could have come up with a humidity answer, but it's just not in the cards.
It doesn't add up. Well, we were talking about humidity, and I mean, I've read Karl Popper. It's all about falsification. You take the likeliest explanation and throw it out, and then what's left is closer to being right.
Okay. Well, hopefully we'll find out.
Okay. So we're talking with Jeff Danner, Common Science blog on our website, chapelburger.com. This week's column has nothing to do with QVC. It's all about hail, which, speaking of storms, we've had a number of really bad thunderstorms, not in the last couple of days, but in the last couple of weeks, and some of them brought some pretty significant hail, and I know you were talking about...
Maybe some of the hail hit that bracket
on the
pole.
Maybe some of the hail hit the bracket, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so talk about hail, because this is a really fascinating... I don't think I've ever said this is a really fascinating form of precipitation ever in my life, but this is a really fascinating form of precipitation.
Yeah. Well, and actually for you, I was trying to work in a Bartholomew and the Ubleck reference during the hail column from Dr. Seuss, but I couldn't get there.
Okay. That's good, because I don't know what you're talking about.
You've had a sad and horrible childhood.
Well, yes, but yeah.
So the origin of this week's column is like many. Someone asked me a question, and I know the answer, but I kind of flub the response, so I get frustrated. And so my wife was asking me questions about hail, and I gave it what I would say is sort of an incoherent, disorganized answer. So I thought, okay, let me try this again. So let's talk about hail.
Okay.
So I say in the column, if you're going to talk about hail, the where you start is just the temperature profile of the air as you rise up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think as people are aware, if you've ever flown on an airplane or studied this in earth science, as you get higher and higher above the ground, or if you go to the top of the mountain, it gets really cold.
Mm-hmm.
And as you get above 10,000, 20,000, even up to 70,000 feet, you can have temperatures that are 2 degrees Fahrenheit, minus 25 degrees Fahrenheit, all the way to minus 70 degrees Fahrenheit at 50,000 feet.
Is that because the air is thinner?
It is, and I moved that explanation to the end note. It's a whole explanation of adiabatic cooling.
Okay.
But the short answer is yes. As gases expand, they cool.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got colder air up there. So then you think about, okay, what happens in a thunderstorm? So thunderstorms have two characteristic airflows.
Mm-hmm.
There's an upward flow of moist air coming up from the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And as it rises up, right, it starts to encounter that cooler air,
mm-hmm.
which makes the air gets more dense. It slows it down, starts to condense the water.
Mm-hmm.
So that warm updraft of air now turns into a cold downdraft of air.
Yes.
That has water droplets in it, and that falls as rain. And as I talked about in a column some years ago, I wrote a column about lightning called Shelter from the Storm, mm-hmm. about how the movement of the water droplets in the air gives you static electricity as it's released as lightning.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you think about hail, the key thing to realize is as that updraft is going up and it gets cold, you start to form these little water droplets. They start out to be quite tiny. So they're still small, but that updraft still has enough oomph to keep pushing it up in the air. So those droplets of air are propelled way up into the air, depending on how strong the flow is. It can be 10,000, 20,000, even up to 40,000 feet, where you're getting towards minus 60 degrees Fahrenheit. So the key thing, and I think the interesting thing is it's rarely reported, is all thunderstorms make hail.
Interesting.
They're all propelling some water droplets up into that air, and they're frozen. Now, most of the time, the little ice particles, hail, that's formed up there, are so small that when they're now falling back down to the earth, they melt again.
Yeah, and become rain. Okay.
And so, but if you have a really nice, strong updraft of nice, moist air, the little ice particles or small hail particles are up there in that cold zone for long enough that they have time to bump into each other, and they're sticky on the outside, and they start to
so they become like
form
bigger
together
pieces,
into bigger and bigger pieces, and now the piece is large enough to fall to the ground.
It doesn't melt in the time it takes to, yeah.
So when you hear the, you know, and I think that's an interesting, that's sort of a scientist view of the thunderstorm. Mm-hmm. I mean, in a practical sense, if you're listening to the weather forecast, what you want to know is, am I going to get hit by pellets of ice or not?
Yes.
But scientifically, you're always having some hail up there, almost always.
Interesting.
And so you can now look at that, and you're always reading about Doppler radar. Mm-hmm. It's able to determine how big are those pieces, and then they could do a quick calculation. Okay, you know, I've got 3-inch chunks of ice up there. They're still going to be at least a half an inch in diameter by the time they hit the ground. Mm-hmm. And that's the way that, you know, when somebody says we're going to have quarter-sized hail or golf ball-sized hail,
right.
That's how those predictions are made.
Okay. So what is it that constitutes, if you can you look at a thunderstorm in advance and be able to say this is going to produce hail?
I think, you know, if you look at, it's really a question of humidity, mm-hmm. Which is, and then air speeds, because they're able to predict what that updraft is like. And so, you know, we have hail here in the Piedmont, mm-hmm. Sort of relatively flat area. As you get closer to the mountains of North Carolina or even out to the Rockies, where a nice strong draft gets pushed up in the air by the mountains, they have hail far, far more often.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really, I think, the key parameter is how energetic is the updraft of warm air.
Okay.
And the more oomph it has, the more chance it has to make good large hail or hail particles, so you know in advance, but then you can measure them.
Okay.
And they can be kind of big. I looked up some hail trivia, and the largest hailstone that's been officially measured, I don't know whose job it is to, like, certify hail, but somewhere out in the Midwest, I think it was in South Dakota back in the 70s, somebody measured an 8-inch diameter piece of hail.
That's what, the size of a...
Larger than a softball.
Yeah, that's not quite a bowling ball, but I'm trying to sort of visualize it right now. But that's huge.
Yeah, those are exceedingly rare.
Yeah,
I checked a couple of sources. 90% of all hail stones, when they reach the ground, mm-hmm. are 2 inches in diameter or less. But still.
Okay. That could cause some damage if it hits something.
And depending on conditions, they can be going from 20 to 100 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
So if you got hit by a 100-mile-an-hour, inch-and-a-half piece of ice,
that would hurt.
Quite painful. So if you look about what are the safety risks and what kind of damages are caused, the people who are hardest hit
mm-hmm.
By hail, I'm smiling at my unintended pun there, are farmers. Because crops can't get out of the way of the hail, and depending on the situation, sometimes livestock can't.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's about $1 billion a year in the United States of agricultural damage from hail. And then, you know, in terms of, you know, sort of other non-farming damage, broken windows, dented cars.
Mm-hmm.
But it's pretty rare. I looked up... I thought, well, okay, that sounds pretty scary. Do people get killed by hail?
Yeah.
And that happens very, very rarely.
Yes.
I found 2 instances reported in the United States in the last 100 years. And I think that's because we kind of know the storm is coming and we tend not to get trapped. I mean, even if you're outside, you know, typically you can get maybe under a large tree or something. So people tend to be able to move out of the way better than livestock.
And lightning strikes seem to be more common then, because not very many people get hit by lightning, obviously, but more than 2.
Oh, right? Yeah. Lightning strikes are people being injured or seriously injured or killed by lightning is far, far more likely, mm-hmm. or far, far more common than a hail strike.
Interesting.
And then I also looked up airplanes.
Okay.
Airplanes do sometimes get some damage from hail, but they're designed for that. And additionally, with the radar that's around these days, even though it seems like sometimes you're flying, you're thinking, can't the pilot fly around this storm?
Yeah.
But they are very effective or very efficient in making sure they don't fly to the heart of a hailstorm.
And I've actually noticed, and I don't know if this is plane design or improvements in radar technology and air traffic control, maybe it's just my memory, too, that I remember flying in the 80s and the 90s, 15, 20 years ago, when turbulence was a common thing, and now a lot less so. And you always hear, maybe I'm just lucky now or unlucky then or something, but you'll hear occasionally the pilot will come on and say, okay, well, we're at 32,000 feet right now, but we're going to drop to 31,000 feet
mm-hmm.
to try to avoid or minimize turbulence. And that actually seems to be really effective?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I have one of my many, many partially written columns is about turbulence. I have some personal experience with some pretty severe turbulence, mm-hmm. which is the heart of that column, and some of the science. I haven't finished it up yet, but now you've added a new paragraph. I don't have the same experience of feeling like it's better, but your theory sounds really, really plausible.
Okay.
And improved radar should allow the pilots.
Well, if I know anything from the previous four-part series, when a scientist says your theory is really, really plausible, that's a huge compliment. So
right,
I'll take
right.
that.
Right, and better yet, it's testable.
Ooh, nice.
So,
all right.
Well,
unfortunately, it's
out.
Also falsifiable, so we'll see.
Oh, that's the downside.
All right. So that's this week's column on hail, and you can check it out now on our website, chapelboro.com. Not going to be with us next week, but what's on tap for the future?
No, I'm picking a rare week off, and I think at this point I have 5 partially written columns.
All
and
right.
so as I'm as we'll see which one piques my interest while I'm away next week, and we'll finish one of those out. So it'll be a surprise to all of us.
All right. Well, sounds good. Jeff Danner, we'll see you in a couple weeks.
Thanks, Aaron.